Lawrence Gonzalez's book is called Deep Survival, Who Lives, Who Dies, and Why. And he joins me now. Hello, sir.
Hello.
How did you become interested in this subject?
Oh, I think I became interested in it when I was a little kid and heard stories of my father's rather amazing survival story in World War II. He was a combat pilot and, in essence, fell 27,000 feet without a parachute. So that kind of caught my attention as a little kid.
I guess so. 27,000 feet without a parachute. Maybe he had a rocket pack on his back?
He was actually in the cockpit, but the plane was torn up so completely that it was kind of like falling 27,000 feet, you know, in a footlocker. And he couldn't get to his parachute and hit the ground. Nobody really knows why he lived and the other 9 members of the crew died. Well, they know why the others died, but why he lived. And, you know, as a little kid, you hear something like this and think, could this possibly be real? And gradually it becomes more and more real, and you start believing in it and asking yourself questions. And I believe that's where it all began.
And your father's story, not only does he wind up alive on the ground, but this is World War II, right? He's a bomber pilot.
Right.
So this is not exactly a friendly place. And he, as soon as he hits the ground, he's in trouble, as I recall the story.
Yes. Actually, there was a local guy, a peasant farmer, and they weren't very friendly toward 8th Air Force guys who were bombing them. So he pointed a pistol at my father's head and pulled the trigger. And that's the cliffhanger in the preface to the book. Needless to say, my father lived through the experience because here I am today. But yes, he had a bunch of close calls.
Wait a second. Folks are going to want to know. So what happens? He pulls the trigger and?
The pistol misfired. While the guy was trying to sort out the pistol so he could shoot my father, who was, by the way, badly injured, a German officer came up and said, you know, I'm sorry, this is a prisoner of war, and we're gonna interrogate him. And then there was a big argument ensued because they said, look at him, you know, he's going to be dead in a minute anyway. so they finally got him out of there, and he was taken prisoner for the duration of the war. But there's quite a lot more to the story. I could have written a book about that alone.
Yeah, I mean, just because he survived the fall, just because he survives this pistol misfiring doesn't mean he's going to get out of the prisoner of war camp alive, does it?
Right. And while he was in prison camp, his buddies in the 8th Air Force were bombing him because they were continuing to bomb this area.
Oh, so great.
He described to me lying in bed. Fortunately, there was a French doctor there who was able to treat him some. He described lying in a bed in this sort of basement hospital. Prison camp, watching the light bulb overhead swing so violently as the bombs dropped around the place that it hit the ceiling and smashed, you know, so it sort of made this arc back and forth until it just crashed against the ceiling, scattering glass all over him.
So to answer the title of your book, what about your dad that determined how it was that he lived? You ask who lives, who dies, and why. Why did your dad survive?
Well, you see, in the book I talk about this, I don't believe that my father's real survival experience was living through that fall. That was the sort of triggering event in what became his true survival experience, which was in picking himself up from that and putting his life back together over the next 40 or 50 years, which he did amazingly well. He had gone into the Air Force with the idea of being a career pilot. He didn't know anything else, and he came out, went on to become the first member of his family not only to get a college degree but to get a PhD, became a scientist, became a medical school professor, put together a whole family and a whole life. And that, to me, is much more the survival voyage of the kind that I talk about in the book that you know, I think is more important to people.
Indeed. Most people, when they hear the word survival, automatically think of facing an extreme life or death circumstances, such as a plane crash or being stranded out in the wilderness. But I grant that your book really expands this definition. So tell us, what do you mean by the term survival?
Well, it's interesting because it's evolved as I've written the book even. I talk a lot in the book about cases where people get into extreme circumstances. One guy breaks his leg at 19,000 feet on a Peruvian mountain and has to spend 6 days crawling off, for example. And that's kind of a classic survival experience. Another guy drifts for 76 days in a raft on the Atlantic. But as I've gone along, I've realized that much of what I talk about as survival is about enduring with grace the challenges that life brings us all the time. one of our growing readerships, for example, is among women who have had breast cancer who read this book and see themselves in it. And they realize that the wilderness is a metaphor and that the survival journey these people go through is the same whether you're going through a divorce or through an illness or a crisis in business or any of these other challenges that we all find in our lives. I always say that everyone has a mountain to climb. And by that I mean that there will come something in your life, if it hasn't come already, that will call upon you to behave like a survivor or, as an alternative, to give up, which is another thing we see a lot in these cases. So I think that's what I'm talking about when I say survival. And we chose the word deep in the title because it really is the first time, so far as we can tell, that anyone has attempted to explain scientifically, in light of new neuroscience that's been done in the last 10 or 15 years, how it is that seemingly rational people do amazingly irrational things to get themselves in trouble, and then how, once they are in trouble, they get themselves out when they do.
Now, in this book, and on the cover, I must say, of your paperback, there's a picture of, I'm going to guess, a dude standing on this tiny little outcropping of rock up on the rooftop of the world someplace, got to be the Andes or the Himalayas or something, with this thin little rope hanging on to him. I mean, talk about putting oneself in harm's way. Your cover is the classic. And let me ask you this. In your book, you mention that, what, you're a pilot, you climb rocks, you go surfing. So, you know, at every turn there, you've got the potential of a crash, a fall, a shark. You take a lot of risks, and you've had some close calls. So I have to ask you, what are your personal experiences with survival situations?
Well, many of them are in the book. I have not had the sort of epic survival journey in my life, like drifting 76 days in a raft. I have had some close calls. But, you know, for all of the risks I've taken and things that I've done, I have always approached them with this in the back of my mind. I'm a writer. That's what I do. I'm not a mountain climber. You know, I'm not a fighter pilot, even though I've flown fighter planes. And by warning myself, you know, that I'm just a visitor here, a temporary visitor here, I've managed to avoid a lot of trouble. When I was flying as a stunt pilot, aerobatics pilot for a number of years, I did come very close to killing myself a few times, and looking back on it, wonder why I managed to get out. But
so what were you? What were you doing in that? You had what, a little Citabria or something, and you were.
I initially learned in a Citabria, and then I moved up to the Pitt Special, which is a very high performance plane that was, rightly speaking, I think beyond my abilities, but that wasn't going to stop me. And the Citabria is pretty forgiving, but the Pitts is not. And I just got myself into situations a few times where it was very lucky that I got home.
And at that moment, did you see yourself as a survivor when you had to make the maneuver that would get you out of the jam that you'd gotten yourself into?
Well, you know, I wrote this book probably 10 years after that period when I was doing that flying. But looking back on it, I think I behaved pretty well. One time I was in an inverted flat spin and experiencing disorientation. I really couldn't get it out of the spin, and I was spinning down toward these trees out in California. And I remained calm, and I did what I had been taught to do, and I did get out of it. But I think one of the key things that survivors do in extreme situations is they're able to control their emotions and not panic or let fear overtake them and simply think through the steps they need to take. And when you're in an inverted flat spin, it's a pretty wild ride. My instructor used to call it Mr. Toad's Wild Ride because the plane is going up, down, sideways, left, right, and you really can't tell sometimes. So I think I behaved pretty well, but, you know, as I say, I'm not sure I've really been tested in one of those huge ways.
So what did you do in the inverted flat spin? How did you get out?
Pull the power off.
Yeah.
Neutralize the stick and press the rudder opposite the way I was spinning. The problem is in an inverted flat spin, it's sometimes difficult to tell which way you're spinning. And in fact, I was having this optical illusion that I was going the other way. So finally, when I switched feet, it came came right out of the spin. And I flew away picking oranges from the trees, so to speak.
Now, throughout your book, you make several references to both Zen and Taoist philosophy. What do those perspectives, what do those philosophies have to do with survival?
Well, in going through the patterns that people use to survive, and I'm talking about everyone from a modern mountain climber to a prisoner at Auschwitz, reporting sort of the spiritual journey that they go through in the course of their survival and suffering, I went back to some of these ancient texts, which I always liked to read anyway, and began just to find these wonderful similarities of thought in them and realized that, you know, what we're dealing with here when we're looking at how people make it through these survival journeys is kind of an ancient and very basic pattern of human behavior and emotion. And so I quote from them in the book because I think people were writing about this stuff long, long ago without specifically calling it this. But it was – I mean, these are books of wisdom, and what is wisdom for if not to help us get through life better?
Yeah, and
– one of the most
– I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say one of the most remarkable things I think that I discovered in the course of writing Deep Survival was the similarity in the reporting of the stories of what they went through, whether you're talking about a guy adrift at sea or a person going through cancer – or Viktor Frankl in Auschwitz reporting his experiences there. And it really is like a vision quest, like the Native American vision quest where you suffer and deprive yourself and then you have this great sort of revelatory moment. So I think it really is something innate in us.
Now, on this business of Zen and look and the Tao, you discuss the importance of maintaining and I quote you here, a Zen mind, beginner's mind in a survival situation. Explain for those of us listening, what is a Zen mind and why is it important to survival?
When I was in survival school, I had this Air Force survival instructor. He used to be with the Air Force Survival School and now runs his own school. And I expected some kind of really macho guy, you know, who was going to beat me up out there in the wilderness. And he turned out to be just the opposite. He was very humble, very soft-spoken, and kept insisting to me that humility was a big part of this process. And I didn't know what he was talking about then, but this is related to the beginner's mind that they talk about in Zen literature, which means you do not assume you know. But if you are an expert and assume you know what you're doing, you're heading for trouble because there's definitely something out there you don't know and you won't have room to take it in. The beginner's mind is open and behaves as if it's empty so that new information comes in and informs you. A big part of the process of staying out of trouble or getting out of trouble is the process of constantly adapting to your changing environment. So if you think you know everything, you don't pick up those changes in your environment, and the environment includes you. So you might not notice that you're becoming hypothermic. Or you might not admit to yourself that you and your wife are having a fight every day and you're heading for divorce. Or you might ignore a symptom that you're experiencing that could signal an illness that needs treating. So we try to talk about keeping an open mind all the time to what's going on around us and within us. And that I believe, is what we're talking about here.
I have to say that one of the most surprising statistics you have in your book is that children under the age of 6 have among the highest survival rates of any other age group. Why is that?
Yes. Now, this is a specific study that I'm referring to there that has to do with children who are lost in the woods. There's a lot of research done on that in Nova Scotia where the search and rescue people develop their techniques. It appears that one of the reasons that this is true, and they do tend to survive better than kids age 7 to 13 or so, and even better than many adults. And it is because they have not yet developed a sense of making mental maps and knowing that you go on a route from here to there. Their brains don't do that yet. And they do not have a concept of themselves as being lost. That's why little kids, if you find one lost in the grocery store, will say, "My mommy's lost. I'm not lost," because they don't think that way. So they don't tend to panic and run. They don't see it as an emergency to cause panic. And then the other thing is they tend to behave very instinctively like little animals. If they're cold, They'll climb into a hollow log to stay warm. If they're thirsty, they'll drink out of a puddle. If they're tired, they'll rest. They tend to make themselves comfortable. And all of that is very important in survival in the woods, certainly. So they tend to live longer. They also tend to present problems for search and rescuers because they tend to hide from them because they get scared of these guys with the big lights on their heads. But it is an interesting fact. Children, but a little older than that, who have developed a sense of spatial navigation and a belief in being lost will panic and they'll run. And they will run across a road. They'll run across your backyard. They won't even think that this might bring them to people, and often they die because of it.
You say one of the most important survival techniques is rest. What do you mean?
Yes. Well, and again, this is it's part of taking care of your internal environment. It's extremely easy in a high-stress situation, and any survival situation is a high-stress situation, to let your body run down to the point that it simply gives up on you. So if you're not taking care of yourself, and again, whether you're talking about being lost in the woods or having cancer, if you're not taking care of yourself, you do not have the resources to go through this survival journey. People who have been in prison camps and given advice to others about what to do if captured say things like this, you know, always eat everything they give you. Always drink the water. Always, you know, get your rest. And these are very important things, not only physically but psychologically.
I want you to tell me one of the survival stories that impressed me a lot in your book, and that's of a 17-year-old girl who was in a plane crash in Latin America, and she, among, what, a dozen people, was the only one to survive. Could you tell us her story and why you think she was a survivor?
Yes, she was in a plane with her mother. She was wearing her confirmation dress and high heels, if I remember correctly. And the plane broke up over the jungle in Peru, I think it was, and people fell out of the plane. She fell out, still strapped into her seat, and they fell into the jungle, and I am speculating that the reason they survived was because the trees broke their falls. In any event, she found herself on the ground alone and pretty much unhurt in the middle of the Peruvian jungle. And the adults who fell out decided to stay and await rescue. This girl looked up and saw that, you know, nobody's going to see you down here under those heavy canopies of leaves. And she decided to walk out. And she had heard somewhere that if you walk down a stream bed, it'll lead you to civilization. So she used that as her strategy. It's not necessarily true, but and she walked for 11 days. She had no equipment, no training, nothing to set her apart except her attitude. And this was a story that was especially important to me because you have to start asking yourself, well, what does determine survival? If it's not equipment and training, you know, why would this 17-year-old make it? And it is a matter of, ultimately, attitude. People who sit and wait for rescue have an attitude that someone else is responsible for them, that someone else is going to take care of them. And that's kind of a deadly attitude. We see a lot of cases from the World Trade Center that worked that way, where people stayed in their offices and said, well, I'm going to wait for the fire department, which, of course, as we all know now, never came. The survivors, in every case that I've seen, are people who tend to first and foremost take responsibility for themselves in their daily lives. This isn't something they invent on the spur of the moment. There's a type of person I refer to as a whiner, and we have all met this type of person who is always complaining and blaming others for what happens and expecting someone to rescue them when things go wrong. And these type of people do not tend to do well in survival situations.
Okay, so we have an idea of what it takes to get out of a dangerous situation. But Lawrence, I'm wondering, what drives us to put ourselves in potentially life-threatening situations in the first place? You know, out there at sea with just in one tiny boat or up on the side of this mountain or going upside down and backwards in airplanes.
Well, we all have this clever little device that we carry around with us, or most of us have it anyway, called a brain. And one component, we think of ourselves as rational beings. We think that our lives are controlled by free will and reason. And the recent neuroscience that I've referred to earlier is showing us that this may not be as much the case as we think.
You mean we don't have brains?
We don't have brains. No, we do have brains. But our reason and our logic are not the things that motivate most of our behavior and direct most of our behavior. The limbic system, so-called, is the seat of our emotions, they would tell you. Our emotional life, including all of these responses that have developed over millions of years of evolution, such as fight or flight responses, mating, hunting, things like that, that other animals than humans do. These emotional responses are still alive and well in the human brain, even though we don't use them in the same way anymore because we tend to live in cities. Those systems are still there. They still need to be used. And for many people, the only way to really get them activated and get them fully charged up is to do something really risky. Now, everyone accepts or enjoys a different level of risk. So for some people, going to a good movie is plenty of excitement. For others, they have to climb Mount Everest. The reason it's so satisfying to use those systems in whatever way we choose to is because those systems are in place to save our lives. They are what keep us alive in a real sense. We don't experience that most of the time because we have everything brought to us. Our food is taken care of. Our shelter is taken care of. But if you go back just a tiny bit in evolution, that's what those are for. You know, unless you hunted, you didn't eat. Unless you fought, you didn't survive, and so on. So when you activate these systems and use them, it makes you feel more alive because it is about saving your life and continuing your life.
So explain then what happens to the role – the roles of emotion and logic when we're faced with extreme situations and in a risky situation where you're also adding stress into the mix here.
Yeah. Well, and emotion is a form of stress. It may be good or it may be bad, or it may be too much. Reason and emotion tend to operate like a seesaw. So the higher the emotion or the higher the stress, the more difficult it becomes to use reason. The reason, which emanates from this part of the brain called the neocortex, neo because it's the newest part in evolutionary history, is simply not that strong a force in our lives. I think we're really on the cusp of a revolution in science right now about that very thing in which we're finding a changing view of ourselves. But when it comes to a contest between reason and emotion, emotion tends to win. And so if we're in a dangerous situation, a hazardous situation, say, you know, up on a mountain, climbing a cliff, or standing in front of a moving vehicle or something like that, and emotion or stress becomes very high, we may not be able to reason clearly about what the next right thing to do is. I see this all the time where I live. There are squirrels, lots and lots of squirrels. And these squirrels get run over by cars, and they never learn. You know, they don't. They're never going to learn not to run in front of the cars. They see this big moving thing coming in front of them. They have an automatic emotional response, and they dash in whatever direction they happen to be facing, which sometimes is in front of the car. We have a little extra brain material that we can use to sort of modify our responses in the long term. It can take work. But we can learn not to respond to those emotions all the time. At least most people can. And I think it is this emotional response that gets us in trouble in these hazardous situations when emotion gets too high.
Well, I certainly have to agree with that. Last year I was hiking with some folks down in the Grand Canyon and came to a section where, to my eye, the trail looked about 2 inches wide. The drop was 20,000 feet. And I don't like heights. I suppose in reality the trail was about 3 feet wide and the drop was, you know, maybe someplace between 500 and 1,500 feet. But, you know, certainly far enough so that I started to get extremely worried. And I was actually having a hard time moving. And then I realized, well, if I froze, I surely would fall, so I just should keep going. Really not look down and not really think about what the consequences were if I had a misstep, but just put one foot in front of the other. So what was going on in my brain at that point?
Well, you were doing a very good job of controlling emotion. And don't forget that if you're hiking in the Grand Canyon, you're also under fire from a number of other stressors, for example, you're probably a little bit dehydrated, you're hot, you're a little tired. So other things are working against you, too, that make it more difficult to reason. But you manage to reason through your circumstances. The trail really is wide enough. You know, if I just stay upright, I'll be okay. Move your left foot, move your right foot. I mean, all of that conscious reasoning is exactly what I'm talking about good survivors doing. There are some people who cannot do that. I've seen situations just like the one you're describing where somebody just sort of squats down on the ground and says, I can't move, I'm too afraid, and has to be rescued. This happens all the time on mountain climbs. People just freeze. So it's an extremely important thing. And animals below humans do not generally find themselves able to do that. I mean, you can train certain animals, but in general you can't because they don't have enough neocortical material to produce what we think of as the kind of analytical reasoning you're talking about, and we do. Many people simply do not learn to use that equipment, and it takes a long time to learn.
Now, another thing happened. I was really cranky with myself for putting myself in that situation at the time. I said, okay, this is really smart, Steve. You come out, you don't like heights, and here you are. There ain't no training wheels, no guide rails here. Why did you put yourself in this situation?
But didn't you feel good afterwards?
It was amazing. In fact, that was the lesson, that if I run into something like that, what I have to do is to just keep moving. And then, in fact, that works. I also found something else which sort of made me a little cranky. The other folks I was hiking with, they had little hiking poles. And on the way back, somebody handed me one to use. And suddenly, for whatever psychological reason or sense that I had something to help me balance myself a little bit better, it became much easier.
Yeah, definitely. Well, it's more than psychological because it gives you some feedback for what they call your proprioceptive system. You know where your limbs are better when you're touching the ground with something.
You write that experience can help us or betray us. What do you mean by this? I mean, can you give me an example or two of how too much training or experience actually becomes a liability in a survival situation?
Well, what I always say when I go around talking about these things to various groups is that experience often means nothing more than that you have done the wrong thing more times than I have. And there are so many examples of it, but getting away with doing something wrong can train you that it's okay. In one case that I examine in the book, there were a group of climbers on Mount Hood who climbed roped to each other, but the rope wasn't tied to anything on the mountain.
So okay.
And now this is a very common technique for climbers to use. So there's a lot of controversy about whether you should or should not do this. But the search and rescue people I talk to refer to a rope as a suicide pact unless it's tied to the mountain. And there are some circumstances in which if one person falls, the others can arrest him. And since they're tied to him, it stops his fall. But, it's a very, very tricky thing to do. And generally speaking, it's not a good idea to do it, I believe. In any event, the top guy fell, dragged all the others off the mountain. They picked up another team along the way down, and they picked up a third team along the way down. 9 people went into a crevasse, and 3 of them died. 3 were critically injured. So this was a big, big event. Many people may remember it because the Air Force helicopter trying to rescue them actually crashed on live TV. So these people were experienced climbers, quote-unquote experienced. They had climbed many mountains this way, roped together with no fixed protection, as they call it, nothing stuck into the mountain to hold that rope. And they had done it over and over again and got away with it. They'd even taken little falls and stopped them. So they had been trained to think that this was a safe technique. Well, we get trained in all kinds of things every day. You know, if you smoke a cigarette and it doesn't kill you, why? It must be safe, right? So you smoke another one. The same can be true of drunk driving. You know, when you read about some huge accident with a drunk driver, you know that that's not the very first time the guy drove drunk, right? I mean, he must have done it before and somewhere deep in his brain thought, well, I guess it's okay. It worked. So that's the kind of thing I mean by experience. You could say he's an experienced driver. he's driven many times drunk. You just have to be careful about what experience you have had and what's it training you to do? What is it training you for? in many cases, you can be trained for very well for one experience that doesn't apply to another. I talk about an Army Ranger who was drowned on a commercial rafting trip because he was highly trained as an Army Ranger, went into the river accidentally, and assumed that because he was so highly trained, he could survive anything, and he was wrong. He didn't know enough about rivers, and he drowned.
So this is how you apply Zen to this. As long as you have the notion that really you don't know anything, that you have mm-hmm. an open mind, then you won't get into trouble thinking that, in fact, you do know something.
Right. When I was learning to fly, my dad used to always tell me, just remember when you approach the airplane across the ramp, you lose half your IQ. And there are lots of these clever pilot sayings they're always throwing at you. But, you know, what he was saying, probably unconsciously, was, you know, be aware that you don't know everything you think you know. And in aviation statistics, there's always a bump at about 400 hours. When you're a brand new pilot, you don't have accidents because you're scared to death. You know, you don't take chances. After you've had a few hundred hours, you start to think you know what you're doing, and that's when you get yourself killed. And then if you get through that period, you sort of learn that you don't know, and you become a wise old pilot who realizes he doesn't really know what's going on, and you become safer again.
Gee, you know, it makes me think of folks who are in the dating game. They never seem to learn.
Some things we can't learn. They're operated by the emotional system.
Part one of your book is called How Accidents Happen. But, you know, after looking at this, Lawrence, I got to say, it seems to me that you're saying that there really is no such thing as an accident. How am I doing in reading your book?
Well, I say that, you know, there are certain accidents that in the Air Force, they call them not your day kinds of accidents because you die. There are certain accidents. You know, if a 747 comes out of the sky and crashes into your house while you're sleeping, we can't fault you for sleeping in that spot. But most of what we call accidents are really put together step by little step, decision by little decision, out of pieces that each would be insignificant if they weren't all strung together in a certain way. And so when you look at them, and I'm talking about, you know, there are great examples out there like the Columbia Space Shuttle. You know, the foam breaks off the tank and it hits the underside of the wing and it happens to ding just the right tile and et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, we put together these accidents in our lives all the time. And if we go back and unravel a few of them for our edification, then it helps us when we are putting together the next one to stop and say, oh, hey, maybe, you know, maybe this is a step I shouldn't take here. And it can interrupt the assembly of the accident before it happens.
I want to talk about people and their instincts. And from the stories you tell, it just seems that some people seem to be instinctually driven to survive more than others. There's the story, that well-known story of the young man in Utah who was pinned under a boulder and forced to cut off his own arm in order to free himself. I mean, for the rest of us whose survival instincts may not be quite as strong, what can we do if we find ourselves in a similarly extreme situation?
The people you're talking about, I don't believe it's instinct. The way the emotional system works is we come equipped at birth or even before birth with certain kinds of instincts. Every baby will startle at a loud sound, for example. Babies will also grasp if they feel that they're falling. They'll grasp with their hands. But the rest of our emotional system, a whole range of responses that come out of the emotional system are built over a lifetime. Each time we have an experience, something happens. You know, we decide to do something. We decide to touch the stove, and it turns out to be hot. We learn something and build that into our emotional system. It becomes sort of a semi-permanent part of us, maybe in many cases a permanent part. As we go through life, we build this incredible library of these little markers that tell us how the world works, how our behavior works in the world, what the results are of this behavior, and each thing gets a little emotional flag that it's good or that it's bad or that it's indifferent. When we get to be the age, you know, adult age where we might be in a survival situation, this is the storehouse of stuff that we're going to be calling upon to save ourselves. If we have built a really strong inner core, a self-reliant person who has a good set of instincts that happen to work in this environment, who has a will to live, who is socially connected to people and activities in the world that he or she wants to get back to, then we have a better chance than if we have built a sort of frail, dependent, unconnected kind of emotional system that may fail us in those extreme circumstances. And so that's what I'm talking about in deep survival when I talk about building the emotional system.
Hmm. Now, towards the end of your book, you have a list of some 12 steps to surviving, that is, 12 things that survivors do which make the difference between living and dying when one finds oneself in mortal danger. Now, some of these are fairly intuitive, obvious, such as staying calm or never giving up, but some are a bit surprising. For example, you say, don't be a victim, be a rescuer. Why do you say this?
Because all of the survivors that I talk about, and indeed all the ones I've heard about, are doing it for someone else. They all report at some point in their survival journey having this sort of conversation with themselves in which they say, you know, my mother told me never to give up, and she just wouldn't be able to stand it if I died. So I'm, you know, I can't let her go through that. I'm going to fight one more day. Or I have to get back to see my son. There was a Japanese soldier discovered, I forget which island it was, after 28 years he had been holding out since World War II. And when they found him, they said, well, how did you do it? And he said, I did it for the emperor. So it's a common theme that goes through, you know, it doesn't matter where you're from or what the geography is, that people are always doing it for someone else. There's a famous psychiatrist named Viktor Frankl who was in Auschwitz and Dachau for 3 years. And he talked about that. He, in fact, wrote a book about it called Man's Search for Meaning, in which he talks about how you have to be doing what you do for someone else to succeed in circumstances like this or for a higher power. So that is what I mean. You start out rescuing someone else by rescuing yourself.
You also say that to survive, one needs to surrender. Can you explain this?
Yes, and in all these cases, again, the same thing is reported. There comes a point when they, in effect, let go of their fear of death, to put it one way. They give up, in a sense. They say, well, I know that I'm going to die. And Viktor Frankl talks about this. In fact, Lance Armstrong, who most people will know, won the Tour de France 6 times after surviving what should have been a fatal cancer. They talk about, well, I know I'm going to die. I'm probably going to die. The chances are really good that I'm going to die. But, and in Lance Armstrong's case, he said, you know, I kind of like fighting against the odds stacked against me, so I'm going to fight another day. There is this moment at which they let go of the outcome and they surrender to the circumstance and just say, my job isn't to decide whether I'm going to live or die. My job is to do the best job of living I can do right now. And that means, you know, taking this next step that is in front of me.
What is there about the survival experience which is a vision quest?
This is another thing that they all report. There comes a moment, and I was just looking at this in Viktor Frankl's book this morning, where they're in Auschwitz. They're terrible suffering. At any hour of the day, they could be taken away and killed, as many of them are. And they're sitting in one of these barracks or whatever that they live in, and some guy comes running in, one of the prisoners there comes running in and says, you have to come out, you have to come out. And they all go out, and what he's dragging them out to see is the sunset. And they stand there and they watch this beautiful sunset, and they all go like, wow, isn't the world beautiful? I mean, these are people who've been in Auschwitz for a year or two already and watched all their families die. It is this capacity, this wonderful human capacity to experience wonder and experience the beauty of a place that comes to survivors at a certain point. And it's almost like a vision, and I believe that the Native American vision quest is connected with this. You know, if you suffer and if you learn to suffer well at a certain point, you really get in touch with that. And they seem to report after having this vision, it's that letting go, that they sometimes become convinced that they will live in some cases. And in some cases, they just sort of let go of it. And it doesn't bother them anymore, and they almost enjoy the rest of the journey.
You seem deeply touched by Viktor Frankl's story, as he tells in his book, This Man's Search for Meaning. At one point, he says that he didn't hate his captors, that he decided that they could do all sorts of things to him, kill him, torture him, deprive him of this or that, but the one thing that they couldn't do was make him hate them. How do you think that ensured or increased the odds of his survival?
Well, I think that, and he talks about this, you know, it's not letting them get at that last core of your inner self, that sacred last bastion of yourself. And I like to say that a survival situation is like a Rorschach because it tells you who you are. It strips everything else away and you find out who you are. And if you have that really strong inner core, that's one of the keys to survival. You know, in Orwell's book 1984, Winston Smith, the main character, talks about having that, well, they can do this to me, they can torture me, they can do that to me, but they can't take away that last, you know, I'm still a rebel in my heart. And of course, in the end, the book ends, I mean, they do get to him. They make him betray his loved one and get into his heart. That's a novel, of course. But I think Viktor Frankl is onto something very important there having to do with survival. And if you go back to the stories, to the teachings of Jesus Christ, you find the same sort of thing. You know, he's being crucified and he's forgiving his murderers. It's a very, very survival-like thing to do.
Because?
Well, it frees you. It keeps your inner sanctum protected. It's still yours. They haven't taken up residence in it, so to speak, the residence of hate.
There's a fascinating story in your book about a personal experience you have in sort of a primitive survival school where you learned about an ancient navigational technique used by Aboriginal peoples called song lines. Tell me a bit about what you learned at this school and tell us what are song lines.
Well, song lines, this particular school uses that term a little loosely, but song lines refers to an Aboriginal practice of singing, it's all part of their mythology, singing the landscape into being. And as they sing these songs, they're actually teaching lessons about geography to children and young people who can then actually use the material in the songs to find their way along a journey. At the survival school I went to, the fellow took me out into the woods. He said, now I'm going to teach you navigation without a map and compass. And my partner and I were like, oh, I don't think so. Anyway, he took us out into the woods and essentially got us lost. We walked and walked and walked, and we were just following him because he was the instructor. And then he said, point the way back to the whatever lodge. And I couldn't do it. I mean, he had gotten me lost. Well, along the way, as we traveled through the woods, he didn't tell me he was going to get me lost. He simply started pointing out things to me that were of interest. He showed me where there was a little vole tunnel where a vole lived. He showed me a certain kind of bark that could be used to make rope with. He showed me various kinds of natural things along the way. So we walked and stopped and talked and walked and stopped and talked. And then he sprung this question on me, where are we? Well, when we went back, he showed me, he said, well, you know, you can see that just back there about 30 yards, we saw this vole tunnel. Why don't we go look at that? And we got there and saw the next thing that we had talked about another 30 yards along. And by stringing these back together into a little story, we found our way back. So he was pointing out to me through this lesson how, in fact, you can keep yourself from getting lost in the woods without map and compass. It takes longer than, you know, rushing through the woods.
What's the worst thing you can do in a survival situation?
Panic, probably. I mean, panic is really, really incapacitating. And anyone who has experienced it knows. I mean, you can't remember the simplest thing, and you're apt to really hurt yourself. And, you know, so that really, that's one of the reasons that I keep that high up on the list of learning to stay calm. People can learn this stuff. It takes a long time to make new connections in the emotional systems, but it can be done.
So there are a lot of things in your book, Lawrence, but what's the most important thing that people should take away from what you've written here?
I was reading the other day about the 4-minute mile. You know, for decades, no one thought it was possible to run a 4-minute mile. And people tried and tried and tried, and there were doctors who just said, you know, it's impossible, humanly impossible. And in 1954, a British guy ran a 4-minute, that is a 50, a 4-minute, 3-minute, 59-second point four, I think it was, minute mile. So he beat it by roughly half a second.
This is Roger Bannister.
Bannister, thank you. Within 46 days, another guy had beat that record. So for all these decades, no one could do it. Within 46 days, someone else beat it. Well, between then and 1999, they knocked 14 seconds off that record. People just kept beating it and beating it and beating it. Now, why is it that nobody could beat it before? You know, human evolution didn't change during that period of time. The reason is because they learned that it was possible. And one of the greatest things about these survival stories is that they give you a sense of what's possible. And in fact, the last line of the last chapter before the appendix in my book is anything is possible. And that, I think, is a lesson I learned from my father. Knowing what's possible is the biggest gift in the world. You know, computer companies, I don't know if they still do this, but when computers were first coming around in the 80s, they would hire guys fresh out of college because they didn't want them to know what was impossible, because if they didn't know, they'd go ahead and invent it anyway, whereas the old experienced guys would say, oh, that's impossible, and they wouldn't do it. So I think that is the greatest gift that I've gotten from writing Deep Survival.
Lawrence Gonzalez's book is called Deep Survival, Who Lives, Who Dies, and Why. Thanks for taking this time with me today.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thanks very much.